In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Coming up is a podcast brought to you by the dedicated and diverse volunteers at 3CR. Just a quick message before you get there. For the month of June, we're asking listeners to donate to the station to help keep us going. We rely on the generous donations of the community to survive. Go to 3cr.org.au/donate and show your support for community-owned and community-run media. Thanks for your support and happy listening.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people on both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And Andy, in many religious traditions, karma teaches us that our actions have consequences across lifetimes. Someone who lives virtuously may return in peace, while someone who strays from the path may be made to suffer. And then there are those rare souls whose past lives' offences were so grave, so cosmically criminal, that they're reborn with an intimate working knowledge of Australian politics. Tonight, our guest, Australia's most trenchant analyst of Auspol, Rachel Withers. Thanks for joining us.
I was wondering where that was going. And yeah, I've clearly done something really bad in a past life. Yes.
Where to begin? A week's a long time in politics. It's been a little while since One Nation got an MP elected.
They've never actually had a. But prior to Farah, they technically never won a lower house seat. But nobody had been elected as one. She got up as an independent after being disendorsed by the Liberal Party back in the 90s, and then Barnaby Joyce defected, but that was the Farah by-election was the first time they've won a seat.
Yeah. So they've gotten one MP now, and then the headlines are Pauline Hanson to be the next Prime Minister. I feel like I may have missed something. What have I missed?
Yeah, we now decide who the Prime Minister is based on who is holding Farah. No, essentially what we've seen over the last 6 months is an ongoing trend of the vote for One Nation rising in the polls. I'd say that a few things in the past month kicked that into overdrive, including the fact that they won a by-election, which further increases the amount of media coverage they get, gives people more of a license to vote for them. It's like a self-perpetuating cycle. So we've now reached the point just this week where we've got polls actually saying One Nation is now on top of Labor, sitting on 31% of primary votes, according to a Redbridge poll. So that's how we get from Farah to Prime Minister Pauline Hanson. But of course, it has been a much longer rise, we could say, for One Nation, or decline for everyone else.
Rachel, One Nation's campaign seems to have the momentum of a runaway freight train. Why are they so popular?
That is more or less the tone of the questions that Pauline Hanson has been getting up until now. You're seeing very softball interviews from people like Karl Stefanovic, who is trying to become Australia's, I don't know, name right-wing podcaster in the US. And they also, generally One Nation does a great job of avoiding serious scrutiny by not actually fronting up to media that would bother to scrutinise them. So you're getting a lot of very gentle media coverage. You'd hope that is about to change, considering they are now the number one party in the polls. One poll, of course, grain of salt, polls are a snapshot in time, but you would think that when a party is considered a favourite by 31% of the nation that they would get some serious scrutiny, but no, all of the scrutiny remains on pretty much just on Labor at the current moment, but also on the left more generally.
Just as an aside, Karl Stefanovic, I thought it was funny that he began this his cooker era, I guess you could call it, when it looked like his contract wasn't going to be renewed. He thought he might reposition himself as like a truth bomb dropping Tucker Carlson type.
That guy.
But then his contract has been renewed. And so he's got to walk this tightrope of still being very much one of the highest paid mainstream journalists in the country, and also having anti-vaxxers and these freaks on his podcast.
Yeah, it's staggering to see him still being given a slot on the Today Show and on Nine interviewing politicians when he's off on the side running a right-wing circus. But yeah, apparently that's fine. And I think we've got a whole lot more of our quote-unquote mainstream media figures flirting with the idea of stuff like this. People like Kyle Sanderland's currently out of work. I'll leave it there, but there are, I don't want to drag too many white male TV personalities through the mud, but there is a lot of people sniffing around in what could be a very lucrative new market, this right-wing podcasting ecosystem, especially with kind of the, if you go online, you do see a lot of very strong support for One Nation in social media comments. So that is something that people like Stefanovic want to capitalize on.
Rachel, I seem to recall that in Pauline Hanson's first speech, she talked a lot about Muslims and about how Islam is incompatible with her version of Australia. And yet it doesn't seem like that's the main plank that she's walking on at the moment. How do you think that kind of prejudice is either being deliberately downplayed, or what's going on? In terms of the, obviously, One Nation is trading on a good deal of resentment that's being generated by all different sorts of social forces. It doesn't seem to have, the emphasis seemed to have shifted from Islam to immigration, meaning essentially the presence of non-white migrant populations in the country. What's your read on how what would previously have been her kind of calling card, which is Islamophobia, where's that situated in the deck and how she's playing her cards now?
She's always shifted the goalposts in terms of those phobias, because if you remember, her maiden speech back in the 90s was about Australia being at risk of being swamped by Asians. So she does shift her target around based on what I suppose she perceives to be the right-wing zeitgeist. I don't, obviously that Islamophobia has not gone away. You see her make comments that are clearly Islamophobic quite regularly. But I think what she's doing as she tries to broaden her appeal is speak about immigration and what it's doing to house prices, what it's doing to people's cost of living, basically tapping into a sense of quite genuine grievance that a lot of people are feeling over the fact that life is getting harder and harder, and just generally blaming that on immigrants. Now, as you say, she clearly means non-white immigrants. You still get a lot of Australian values and that kind of stuff, but both One Nation and the Coalition are blaming migration more broadly for a lot of our social ills. And that, of course, is something that we've been watching play out in the US, in the UK, and now here. It's almost surprising that it took so long for this sense of grievance to be weaponized here in the way it has been in a lot of the other Western world countries.
Obviously, there are failings on the part of the media in terms of interrogating One Nation, its policies or lack of policies, and so on. And also, just to, in many respects, we're operating within a degenerated mediascape. But I wonder, the other thing that occurs to me is that I've recently been reading through a document that Trades Hall produced called Antidote, which argues that trade unions are the solution to the far right. I'm still reading through it, so I'm not quite sure how it proposes to enact that solution. But do you see, it seems that there's a relative absence of other political or social forces that might take up the fight that are embedded in these communities and can explain, for example, Hanson's policies on workers' rights, on unions, and across a whole range of issues. She takes a position that's, I think, unpopular in terms of whether it's income redistribution or all manner of things. These things don't seem to be registering in terms of how she's actually situated, being sponsored by Auntie Gina and so on. In other words, the kind of the impacts that the success of One Nation would have on the lives of ordinary workers, that doesn't seem to be an argument that's being effectively presented to those who might be potentially voting for her and her party.
Yeah, no, there's so much in that question and so many good points. I think in the past week you've seen Labor really try to step up attacking One Nation on the fact that it often votes against workers' rights and pay rises for those on minimum wage and against housing affordability and against all of the things that are in its voters' best interests. But I think at this point, Labor has lost those people who are going to One Nation already. They've stopped listening because they've stopped listening to the two major parties who aren't actually doing anything to solve their problems, who are in government in the case of Labor and in the case of the coalition were in government and didn't do anything. So I think even as Labor tries to get that message out, then Pauline Hanson doesn't really speak for working people. They've unfortunately lost so many of them. I would say there's a role for the trade union movement to play here. It's unfortunate that it's been so hollowed out by successive governments. But I do think it does need to be working people who are able to speak to working people about why One Nation is not in their best interests. And it's a really major challenge when we seem to have a bit of a vacuum on the left right now. We don't have a lot of people who are able to lead those conversations. And I almost wonder if the only way people will realize that One Nation doesn't speak for them is if they actually get into government and then don't do anything for them, arguably make things worse for them. But that would involve One Nation getting into government. And also, like you see with Trump, they often don't care once they get their outsider into the seat of power. It's a tough one. And I think what we are seeing, unfortunately, with the way both the Coalition and One Nation are painting even minor attempts by Labor to try to even the scales a little bit as communism, is that a lot of the people who need kind of socialist policies have been convinced that communism is bad and communism is higher taxes and basically that they've done a very good job of convincing people that the things that would help them are the things that are hurting them. So it's going to be very difficult to unpick this mess. And I'm sure that is something you guys can use this show to figure out how to do.
Rachel, the Liberals have got a solution to the encroaching threat of One Nation, which is to bring back an old classic, Tony Abbott. Tony Abbott's ascension to the Liberal Party leadership position going to save the Libs?
Yeah, look, I wrote about this for Crikey this week and they actually emailed me and said, do you want to write about Tony Abbott? And I went, a classic. He is a classic. This is a classic topic. I feel like I've written it so many times now. Tony Abbott is a classic. And the Liberal Party just keeps wheeling out these figures from another time that only appeal to the dwindling base that it has, that is the older, whiter, male demographic. Those are the ones that they are winning for now, and not bothering to speak to women, young people, and migrants, which review after review says is exactly who they need to speak to. The average Liberal Party member is a 68-year-old man, whereas the average Australian is a 38-year-old woman. And it's just baffling that they would think that they could continue to go after this shrinking demographic. I'm sorry to say the boomers are going to slowly die out. And I say that my mother is a boomer, love her dearly, but the boomers are a dwindling voter base. And that seems to be all the Liberal Party knows how to appeal to. Obviously, they are absolutely freaked out about losing what is left of their base, their old white men, to One Nation, which they are. But Tony Abbott doesn't help them win back the kind of broader coalition that they would need to win a government ever again. It almost sounds ridiculous at this point to talk about them winning government ever again. It feels like they're pretty much done. But if they really wanted to return, they would need to broaden their base significantly.
Do you think that Tony might have picked up a few ideas at Hungarian CPAC that are going to help them in that effort to move back to the centre?
Yeah, he has been just off with the fringes for the last couple of years since being voted out of Warringah. I don't know. It almost looks more and more likely at this point that One Nation and the Liberal Party will merge. We're seeing this week that following those massive One Nation polling numbers, they're suggesting potentially an alliance with the Liberals at some point. The Liberals are saying no. But if Tony Abbott is your president and Angus Taylor is your leader, you make a lot of sense teaming up with One Nation. I wonder if that did happen, if you would finally see the quote-unquote moderate Liberals. I don't know that there are any left in there. But them break away and become a some kind of centre-right force, because there's a vacuum there too, which Labor is more than happy to fill. But they can't fill every gap. Yeah, I don't think Tony's the solution. I think he is probably only going to accelerate the Liberal Party's decline.
Maybe the moderating influence in that coalition will be the likes of Jason Virgo, the South Australian One Nation MP who thanked his Muslim, Asian, gay partner in his maiden speech. He seemed to have missed a few memos.
We've had him this week. We've also had David Farley, who won Farrer, the One Nation candidate there, come out and say that he will have the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flags on display in his office. And Pauline Hanson's kind of gone, wouldn't do that myself, but each to their own.
It's a broad church.
It is a broad church. And I think as One Nation tries to broaden its own base and become a major force in politics, it is going to have to include people who aren't openly xenophobic. I think that is still the root of the party. But you're going to see like recently arrived immigrants explaining why they're voting for One Nation and saying, oh, no, it's not a racist party. I think with any of those other individuals who are not racist or don't perceive the party to be racist or are not aware of their own internalized racism in some cases, maybe, I think those are the people that the two-party system has stopped speaking to and who are reaching for One Nation just because they're looking for an anti-establishment, blow up the system, stick it to the politicians option, which is what Pauline Hanson represents and why she's growing in popularity, not necessarily because she's openly Islamophobic. Yeah, it's a difficult one. I had Jason Virgo in South Australia, though. He's a particularly extreme case of someone not really making sense in One Nation. I have heard he has previously been a member of Labor. He's one of those political floaters who's jumped between parties and clearly just likes to be included. But yeah, certainly I think you are going to see more and more people in One Nation that I would describe as decent people. I'm currently looking for one, actually, for a panel I'm organising on the realignment of the political system. And I'm very casually differentiating between what I see as the decent One Nation spokespeople, candidates, party people, and the racist ones.
It occurs to me that one thing that might be motivating Tony Abbott and other Liberal Party loyalists is they understand that One Nation has a history of being unable to govern or to operate as a party effectively. The kinds of tensions that are present through the election of this person or that person, all those tensions have yet to be tested. So the real test is coming. And I think if you're thinking about the party's history, its fairly shambolic organisation, or the fact that the party itself is grants to Hanson dictatorial powers across the entire party, it's not a democratic party, you might expect them to, in a sense, implode in office. And it might be possible at that stage to recombine the Liberal Party or some other conservative right-wing party that takes advantage of that. So there's a sense in which maybe it's worth some elements of the Liberals hedging their bets or holding their fire to see One Nation be tested in office, found to be wanting, and then for the party to reconstitute itself if it's a slightly differently composed, that's fine, but the party still perhaps on that basis has some kind of a future. The only exception I'd say might be regional rural Australia, where the Nationals, as I understand it, are at real risk of being completely wiped out by the One Nation party vote.
Yeah, but I think what you might see, I'm only really just thinking about this now, but if the One Nation was to get a sizable number of seats and then do the implosion that we're all expecting, you would see some drift to the Liberal Party, but I think you'd also see a lot of them drift to the Labor Party and potentially also to some kind of regional representatives party if the Nationals are gone at that point, because they'll all be quite different depending who they are and where they got elected. It's almost like some of them will end up independent, some of them will. I think the closest example I can think of is what happened to all the different Palmer United people over the years after Clive Palmer got a whole bunch of people up and then the party imploded. Jackie Lambie became Jackie Lambie, and then she got up Tammy Tyrell, and Tammy Tyrell left Jackie Lambie to join Labor. Like, these people can go all over the place. I do think Labor and Liberal are limiting categories that can't capture a lot of the individuals who are coming up through the political system now. But I think a lot of them will fall back into those roles.
Rachel, we've recently had a federal budget, and this seems to be sending quite a few people over the edge.
Including myself.
Senator Andrew Bragg described it as a communist budget. I did wonder why so much of it had been earmarked for seizing the means of production. Yeah. Is this really a communist budget?
I have started joking that the next person to call it a communist budget should have their house seized and turned into public property so they can learn what communism is, because Andrew Bragg clearly doesn't know what communism is. He is actually, I've been tracking, he's called it communist on Twitter 8 times in the last 2 weeks. The Daily Telegraph's called it communist. Pauline Hanson's called it communist Marxist. It is not a communist budget, obviously, but nor is it even that radical of a progressive budget. What we're looking at here and what everybody is losing their minds over and calling communist is the changes to tax concessions for passive income, for people who make money off investments, that is currently taxed lighter than people who make their money by working. That's like the core of what is going on. It's an absolute distortion that we even have these tax breaks for people who make their money through capital. Labor is gently, ever so gently, taking them away, grandfathering some of them, but gently taking the blanket away. And yeah, we're being told it's communist. It's patently ridiculous for anyone who either understands what's in the budget or what communism is. And I think ultimately it's not really going to make much difference to the material conditions that are causing everybody to feel so pessimistic and being driven into the arms of the anti-establishment far right. So it's, yeah, in many ways it's even more ludicrous to call it communist, because maybe communism actually would help people, but this doesn't.
Rachel, do you think a couple of secondhand subs might cheer people up?
I don't want to do this AUKUS.
Fair enough.
Do we not have enough going on? Just cancel them and give everyone the money. I don't know. I'm not an economist. But it's like, are we really going to get into this argument again? We've seen Ed Husic come out and question whether we should still be going ahead with AUKUS. Peter Garrett, former Labor minister, running an inquiry. And it's, come on, it's so simple. Just like, you got cornered into doing this thing that you didn't like. The coalition are bullying you to stick with it, but also nobody cares what the coalition thinks or says. Just rip it up and help people instead. If you want to stop the rise of the far right and actually help people at the same time, it seems like the dumbest thing we could be doing with our money.
Yeah, that is, until the far right begin their maritime invasion and we wish we had some defences.
Oh, yes. Actually, but isn't it that sometimes the Fox News hosts suggest they should invade Australia to save us from our communism? Have I got that right? Like, a few years back, there was a Fox News host suggesting that we needed saving. So maybe we need subs to defend our communism.
Rachel, on that note, we will leave it there. If people want to hear more of you, they can get you on Triple R, on Spin Cycle, or they can find you, of course, on Crikey. Thanks for joining us.
No worries. And also, if I might just do a little plug for that event again that I'm hosting at the Brunswick Ballroom on July 7, about the kind of breakdown of the two-party system or the realignment of the political system. It should be a really good event. You can find tickets on the Brunswick Ballroom website.
Absolutely. Get along. And Andy, that is our show. We will be back next week with our Radiothon show, where we are going to be asking you to give us $4,500. I feel like the communist budget should have sorted that out, but apparently there was no money for Yana Fasaran in the budget, so we are going to need you, the listener, to step up on that one. So we'll catch you next week.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
Yeah. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
This June, we'll be asking for your donations to support 3CR.
Your donation during Radiothon keeps the station radical and enables us to give voice to our community for another year.
All donations over $2 are tax deductible.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au. Show your support by donating this June.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganite Correctional Centre and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is afire.
Celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.